Father Snyder, in inviting me, gave me a vague and usefully vast topic, the role of the Christian, of a Catholic or Christian intellectual. I know some of you are not Catholic, but I think it will apply reasonably closely to some of the things that you may aspire to yourself, even if you're not a Catholic. And so what I thought I would do, Nietzsche says somewhere that every idea has its autobiography. And I thought what I would do is just present you with some of the themes that in 30 years of living here in Washington and dealing with both on the one hand some more technical academic kind of studies, books of my own that I've written, and engaging the public square. I know a lot of you are interested in politics and law, etc. I thought probably that would be the sweet spot for me. That would be the place where I could perhaps make the biggest contribution for you. Now, to approach a big subject like this is both attractive and dangerous, of course, because it gives you an opportunity to pick up on larger questions, but it's also, I'm constantly aware of this because of the tendency of everybody in Washington to be a pundit. I guess everybody in the world these days who goes on Twitter is a pundit, but I'm quite aware that there may be some areas I'm going to stray into that I'm not an expert in, but I'm going to try to talk out of my own experience, and if I make mistakes, of course, you can correct me when we get to the period of questions and answers. Specifically, what I'd like to do is talk about three large subjects. We're all Trinitarians here, aren't we? So three is always a good number, too. First thing I'd like to do, because I think that this is, it's important, while you're doing your technical studies in law, philosophy, theology, etc., it's important to know the world that you are in. So the first thing I'd like to do is talk a bit about what I think are the distinguishing characteristics of the moment that we're in right now. And then second, what I'd like to do, non-Catholics, please give me a little slack here, I'd like to talk about the specific characteristics of the Catholic Church at this moment, which I think are unusual. Some of you may not agree with the way that I'm going to approach that. And then finally, I'll look at the role or roles, because to be a Catholic intellectual, a Christian intellectual at this moment in history, is not a monolithic kind of thing. Not all of us are going to engage politics, or not all of us are going to be doing technical, academic, scholarly work. So there's a broad spectrum of things, but I'd like to just lay out some of those in the context of what's happening in the world and what's happening in the church. Because these are questions that all thinking Catholics, not only those of us who are sort of professionally intellectuals, all thinking Catholics have to do. Now, I want to say right away, however, that you cannot do anything serious as a Christian intellectual unless you first do several other things, such as pursuing holiness and wisdom, prudence and humility. And I don't mean just understanding what those ideas mean. I mean, it's always the temptation of an intellectual to think that what he or she has understood, he or she is capable of actually doing. And it's part of the intellectual life, it's part of our development as human beings, simply to recognize how relatively easy it is to understand prudence, wisdom, those sorts of things, and how relatively hard it is actually to bring them into your own life and live them. There's a famous passage in the first chapter of The Imitation of Christ that some of you probably know. I'd just like to quote it to you briefly. What doth it profit thee to enter into deep discussion concerning the Holy Trinity if thou lack humility and be thus displeasing to the Trinity? For verily, it is not deep words that make a man holy and upright. It is a good life which maketh a man dear to God. I had rather feel contrition than be skillful in the definition of contrition. That's part of the intellectual life, making sure that we form ourselves in a way that our thought, our emotions, our actions are all in harmony with one another. Now, this is particularly hard for everybody, but it's particularly hard for intellectuals. Because We run hard at the truth. We care about the truth. And when we think we've gotten some portion of the truth, it's difficult to be humble about it. It's difficult to be in conversation with other people who don't see things exactly the way we do. And the minute you step out of your own attempts to kind of formulate and to harmonize different truths, and you step into the messy world, which is, let me tell you, right down the hill from here, messier than most other places, to learn how to hold on to the truth and discuss other people, the truth with other people, is in itself an intellectual achievement. So one worth pointing to right at the beginning. And this brings me to my first main point, which is about what is the nature, the characteristic nature of the world that people like us who are thinkers, what is the characteristic nature of the world that we're in right now? Since you've been studying natural law this week, I thought it would be useful to remind ourselves that one of the ways that lots of people, secular people as well as people dedicated to Christian view of the world, one of the ways that people describe this moment is post-truth. Post-truth, so far as I was able to figure out, was first used back in the early 1990s. But I think, you know, we can look back further. I remember being here in Washington in the 80s, and we were doing a lot of work on post-structuralism, deconstruction, postmodernism, which has kind of dropped out as a main conversation topic. But it was there already. The idea that there are no stable texts, that, you know, truths are sort of an expression of power rather than an expression of a recognition of reality. And this idea of post-truth, I think, helps us understand a whole variety of phenomena that we see these days, particularly in the West, in North America and Europe and Australia and places like that. Because what's happened is that we're now at a point where metaphysics, ontology, and epistemology are all in play in public. Now, if you had asked someone maybe in the Middle Ages if that was a good thing, they'd say, hey, that's great. People are discussing metaphysics and being and how we know things. But let me tell you, in politics, that is not good. It's not good when there are competing, what Richard Weaver called metaphysical dreams of the world. What's good about a metaphysics and a kind of a general sense of the world is when it's implicit, and it's sort of the background that is stable behind us all. It's not good when we're at the point where people with differing metaphysical views and different ontological views are battling it out in public. And without a common view, I think that we very quickly start to sink as a civilization. We all feel that in some odd sense, our civilization, which is tremendously wealthy, tremendously powerful, dominant around the world, is at the same time crumbling or decaying, or at least in peril in some fashion. And one of the images I like to often use is, you know, that probably you're all too young to remember this, but there's an old cartoon called Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote pursues Roadrunner, and, you know, Roadrunner travels all over the place, and Wile E. Coyote is chasing him, and he runs off, and he doesn't realize he's gone off a cliff, and his legs are still, you know, going furiously. Then he realizes, wait a minute, there's nothing underneath me, and, you know, then he drops down. We maybe aren't exactly there yet, but we're getting close to the edge. We're getting close to the edge where there are enough people, I think, who no longer believe in a substantial notion of the truth of beings, including human beings in the world, and of truth. I'm sure you've discussed this during this week, because the two starkly opposed metaphysical views, in my opinion, that are at play right now, and they do kind of line up with the political parties even a little bit. In one, we've got, how shall I put this? In one, we've got the older view that God is the creator, that there is a creation, that there is human nature that's been created. There is truth and all those things behind the truth that indicate to us whether human beings are going to flourish or not flourish. And if you have that older view, it can be a Jewish view, it can be a Protestant view, a Catholic view, it can be an ancient philosophical view like you find in Aristotle. If you have that view, you believe that human life will do best when it is, when it follows kind of the rules. It follows the framework that is that we all exist in. Now, obviously, contrary to that, and it takes a little metaphysical excavating to get to this, but the diametrically opposite view of that is that there's not a creator, and there's not a creation, and there's not a human nature in the sense of something substantial that we need to understand and live according to within these larger frameworks. And this has been, of course, exaggerated by digital media, but it's not produced by digital media. It's a philosophical point of view that isn't necessarily expressed in philosophical or theological terms, but is implicitly there. And the odd thing about this view, as I'm sure several of you know, is that on the one hand, we don't believe in substantial truth, we don't believe in substantial right and wrong, and yet, on the other hand, when a person's right to define himself as herself or herself as himself and, you know, similar things like that is challenged, it's cosmically, fatally wrong. That somehow there's right and wrong about a particular set of things having to do with the human will being able to determine itself absolutely and to demand that the world make possible many things that are quite impossible, such as changing gender, I would say. And this all came to a point in a famous phrase that it's the heart of liberty to be able to define to be able to provide a definition of, I quote, existence, of meaning of the universe, and the mystery of human life. That's the famous passage from Justice Kennedy and Casey, as I'm sure you law students are aware of. Look, that position has existed philosophically, as we know, probably since philosophy began, that human beings make their own reality, their own truth, their own good, their own heaven and hell. But it's never, I think, been the case that the more substantial kind of natural law view, just to use that term as shorthand, and this radical autonomy view have been clashing in public to the degree that we have right now. And unless we understand that that's the world that we operate in as Christian intellectuals, we're going to make several mistakes, not only in reaching out to that world if we're called upon to do that by our vocations, but also in the way we formulate certain things. We're going to think we're talking about similar things with people we encounter, and they're actually going to be understanding our words in a very different way. I mean, you see this very clearly, that when in public someone talks about the older natural law views, it's regarded as oppressive, perhaps as hate. The talk itself is hate speech, as bias, as an attempt to control people, when in fact those natural law principles are intended to empower people, to tell us what it is that enables us to be happy. And it's no surprise that people who embrace that that radically autonomous view are perpetually unsatisfied. I mean, it's not only Augustine who knew our hearts are restless until they rest in thee, right? If you can have everything that you want or demand everything you want from people around you and still feel dissatisfied, still feel like there's something more that has to go on, you put yourself in a very difficult situation. And I think we have to say candidly, what this means is that in our society, and I'm going to get into this as we get into what we're responsible for doing about it, and I'm not sure that there is a lot that we can do about it. Michael Hanby always says at least we can know what's happening to us, and that's an important thing. But I came across this word the other day, solutionism. Has anybody ever heard this? This is the belief that there are actually solutions for every problem, and I have to say I'm not so sure that there are. But let's keep this part of the perspective in mind. For those of us who are substantial Christians, Protestant or Catholic, or for that matter, somebody who is an Aristotelian, a substantial Aristotelian, we've got to recognize that the heart of liberty, as it's been defined in that Casey view, where we have a radical capability of defining truth in our own selves, has to think about the churches, about the biblical tradition, about the ancient philosophical tradition as outside the bounds of respectability. We're not quite at the point where the churches are regarded as the Ku Klux Klan, but it's close. You know, you see this in the controversies when there are legal decisions being made. You see it in the controversies on college campuses, I think, as well. Now, the problem with this view, this autonomous view, is that it demands, I mean, the deepest problem with it is that it demands respect for human will, but it can't tell us why, right? I mean, the only thing you can say is, I want X, but it can't tell you why anybody else has an obligation to respect what you say, other than, you know, someone politically tells you you have to do it, or you get fired from your job, or you know, you get shunned for your points of view. We ignore what people want all the time. I have a Catholic friend who said he's been offended his whole life and no one has ever cared a whit about, you know, being a Catholic in modern America. And I think there's a kind of humorous truth to that, right? I think it was Harvey Mansfield at Harvard who once said, you can tell who has power in a society by who's allowed to get angry. You know? Think about that. You know, think about that. Who's allowed to get angry in public? And who do we think, when they get angry, it shows conviction, and we, you know, we're supposed to pay attention to that, and who, when they get angry, probably us, is regarded as angry, and, you know, someone not to be paid much attention to. Very important point, I think. And since these things are being enacted in practice, you know, those of us whose business is ideas, those of us who are going to have to be in the public square and talk about these things. I mean, lots of you, I think, are planning academic careers, law careers, maybe media. The horizon is shrinking for Christians. I've said, I don't think we're quite at the point where the church is the Ku Klux Klan, but it's shrinking, and intellectuals must be aware that of the dangers that are to come, and I'll talk about that a bit later. But let me turn to my second large thing. Where's the church in all of this? Now, I've been involved in conversations between Catholics and Protestants for probably 30 or 35 years in this town and elsewhere. And I've got to tell you, this is a funny phenomenon, but back in the 80s, every time I heard somebody talking about natural law in public, it was a Protestant. And it was because Protestants came along and when they were trying to re-engage, evangelicals were trying to re-engage with the public square, They weren't getting anywhere by just citing Bible verses. But if you talk in terms of natural law principles, of reason, you can make some headway. One of the reasons I founded Faith and Reason Institute back in 1999 was that I had finished my book on the 20th century martyrs, and I wanted to start something that was going to sort of carry forward some of the initiatives that John Paul II had put out there. And I'd been here almost 20 years already in a different think tank, Ethics and Public Policy Center, and it kind of struck me that there isn't exactly a glut of either faith or reason in Washington, and they were both growth industries, and therefore I would never go out of business, and I haven't, so it's been wonderful. But I want to point to the fact that, although I'm putting it somewhat humorously, the church, where is the church in all? Now, we know of pockets in the church. We know of particular figures in the church who know how to engage the world that we live in right now and know how to, within the church itself, speak in ways that make the church what it ought to be, which is the mystical body of Christ. It follows loyally Christ in our time, you know, adapted to our time, but following primarily Jesus himself. I'm going to speak as a Catholic about Catholics, and I'm going to be blunt about this. Some of you may disagree with me, but I covered the election of Pope Francis for EWTN in 2013. So I was present at the creation, and I've been following him all along. And I'm going to say that the church has continued to be critical of society in some ways. I think all of you probably know he's been very forceful in talking about environmentalism. He's been very forceful in talking about inequalities and poverty. And he's been very forceful in talking about immigration and the need to take in as many immigrants and refugees as possible. I think all of that is fine, and it can be debated how you do those things. And that obviously is going to be the public policy debate. Everyone thinks we should take care of the poor, that we should receive refugees who need a refuge. Everyone thinks that the natural world should be protected, both for our good and for its own sake. But what I think has happened with Francis, and he made remarks about this very early on in his papacy, is that he's reduced the amount of energy that the church puts into what I'm going to call the culture war, just for shorthand. Okay, I mean, those things that really impact people at a specific point in their life, abortion, marriage and family. We've now seen homosexual marriage, which he's repeatedly said is not really marriage. But he hasn't, you get the impression that his heart is not in it. And I think one of the reasons is that he doesn't, I don't know whether this is him personally or whether it's his judgment about the moment that we live in. He doesn't really want to engage at the level of ideas. I wouldn't say that in a lot of audiences, but I think with this audience, it's good to put it that way. The level of ideas. And there have been several confirmations of this. Father Antonio Spadaro, who's a Jesuit, who is the editor of a very important journal called Civita Cattolica in Rome. He's very close to the Pope. He did the interview with the Pope very early on, in which Pope Francis said, Catholics should not be insisting and obsessing constantly on abortion and homosexuality, which I can tell you angered an awful lot of people here in Washington who have dedicated their lives to trying to protect the unborn and to trying to build up marriage. Now, you know, we know in a way what he means. You shouldn't be a monomaniac about these things, or a dual-maniac, I guess. But at the same time, it was clear that he was going to back off a little on that, and he wanted to talk about other things. And I'm going to just give you my own theory of how, partly how this has been justified. Because Spadaro did this in that same interview with him. Or no, I don't think it was in that interview. I think he said later. And we only have Spadaro's word for this. But Spadaro said that the Pope, using some Jesuit mode of discernment and spirituality that I'm not exactly clear about. Maybe somebody in the room will be clear about this. What he likes to do is he likes to look at a problem and pray on it and contemplate it and then seek a solution to it or some act that he's going to carry out without worrying about, you know, how it corresponds with other truths of the faith or other activities. And I think that's right. And in one way, that wonderful charismatic quality that he has of just on the spur of the moment reaching out to people, I think stems directly from that way of thinking and that way of being. But as Catholics, and I think as Christian intellectuals more generally, we have to be more attentive to ideas as such. So we can't simply be focused on immediate accompanying people or showing mercy toward people. That's all great. I don't want to denigrate that. But here's where I think the upshot comes out when he does this. Remember, he's used this famous phrase that the church is like a field hospital, right? Some of you probably heard him talk about that. And, you know, given human evils and the fact that we struggle with principalities and powers, as St. Paul says, the world is always pretty much a mess. One of the first things I learned when my boss at Ethics and Public Policy said to me, look, get over your idealistic stuff, reading Dante and reading all these poets and whatnot. There are always 40 wars going on in the world at a time.
Yeah.
Maybe it's 35 in a good period, maybe it's 45 in a bad period. There's constant turmoil, there's constant conflict in the world. And it's good to remember that, because we don't want to, we live in a very privileged, powerful, peaceful country in many ways. And we don't want to assume that human life, either here or around the world, is simply that, that it's sort of a suburban tranquility that we're all going to live eventually when we get rich enough, that there's conflict constantly going on. So the field hospital is a good idea. But in addition to treating people who are being have been wounded and they're kind of critical, if you're going to be a good doctor, you have to have studied medicine. You have to know something. Because you can hold someone's hand and have a good bedside manner, and you can reassure them, and that's very much to the good, and you should do that if you're a doctor. But if you're going to cure somebody, if you're going to really cure somebody and maybe cure a battle that's going on or stop a battle, you need more than just that immediate emotional connection with people. You need to know truths, and you need to be able to move persons toward truth and to treat them on the basis of truth. It's odd to me, but it's beyond dispute, that Pope Francis has said over and over again that he's worried about what he calls doctrinal rigidity. And it must correspond to something in his personal background. He even, at the Chrism Mass on Holy Thursday this year, just a couple months ago, he said this, I'm going to quote, it's not that long. "We must be careful not to fall into the temptation of making idols of certain abstract truths. They can be comfortable idols, always within easy reach. They offer a certain prestige and power and are difficult to discern. Because the truth idol imitates, it dresses itself up in the words of the gospel, but does not let those words touch the heart. Much worse, it distances ordinary people from the healing closeness of the word and the sacraments of Jesus." Now, I think we can all recognize a certain type of person here, you know, somebody who knows everything that Aquinas said about, you know, some particular point, but doesn't really, whether as a priest or as a lay person, engage other people with charity, with Christian humanity. So he's right to point to a certain type of problem. But if I'm right, from my first point, that the world that we live in now is a post-truth world, and that even secular people are saying this, not just we fussy Christians who want to look at where the world is, the secular world is at the moment. If it's true that really the thing that we face is a post-truth world, I'm not sure that this is the main problem. It seems to me that we've got to find some way to be able to talk to that world and explain to it why it is that truth matters, that truth exists, and that we need to bring truth into the public realm. Now, some of you may want to dispute that. I just wanted to put that out there. I just don't think that the immediate problem is that Catholics and other Christians are too much obsessed with truth. I travel to a lot of foreign countries, and I have to say that if you ask me if too much truth is the problem in Washington or in Paris or Vienna or someplace, I think almost anyone would say that's not the main problem. All right, so now I'm going to go to my third point. Let's talk a little bit about, so what are we supposed to do? If solutionism is kind of an illusion, what are we thinkers, people who are trying to study and understand the truth? And we have in Christianity the longest truth-seeking tradition, in my view, on earth. I said this when I founded the Catholic thing, that the Catholic thing was going to try to present the Catholic tradition on a daily basis to people who maybe knew part of it or maybe were not familiar with it. But that it if you look back over 2,000 years, and a church that survives the rise and fall of empires and civilizations and whole cultures and survives and grows and reaches every part of the world, it's a miracle. In fact, Aquinas says at one point that it's one of the greatest miracles that these poor fishermen and tax collectors were able to produce a religion that moved all over the globe, the inhabited globe. So, given that we have this richness, and in some ways it's hard to see that tradition, that Christian tradition, also rooted in several thousand years of Jewish tradition, it's hard to see it because it's so big. It's had such a presence, such an influence on the world that we live in, it's hard to see it. We know why we think people have dignity and need to be respected. It's because they've been created by God. What other arguments are there out there? Some of you in law studies may come up against this question. Well, how do we think that rights exist if human beings are kind of self-determined? Do I have to respect your self-determination? Do you have to respect mine? Now, a Christian intellectual is going to have a vocation to some part of a tradition that's too large for any one of us to know or any one of us to respond to entirely. And that means, you know, some of us are going to do technical academic studies like Father Torrell does of St. Thomas. Some of us may do theoretical legal work or practical legal work. We may be in academic environments where we try to teach people about the tradition and try to form the next generation in the world. And some of us are going to, I hope, also try to preserve that tradition within the church itself, because the church existing in a post-truth world is constantly tempted to just go along to get along. So what I'm going to do is, in this section, I want to just talk about some of my own experiences. And one thing I'd like to put before you is that I hear a lot from people who read the Catholic thing, who are Catholics, but don't understand faith and reason. What they say to me is, you know, I understand reason, I understand what science is, you know, I like science. I was talking to somebody who was a physics student here. I was a physics student when I started out in the university, so I'm still curious in an amateur's way about science. But a lot of people think that the only form of reason is scientific reason. You know, and anyone who uses reason in a philosophical or theological way knows very quickly that you get into questions that that show that kind of narrowing of reason is almost impossible to maintain. But there are many more things about human beings and about the world in general than that kind of scientific reason. But a lot of people think of that as reason. And the same people, they'll write to me and say, you know, I really need someone to explain this to me. I wish the Dominican House had outposts everywhere. I'd send them to the Dominicans, who were formed to do this sort of thing. On the other hand, they look at faith, and they think that faith is magic. You know, they know that there are mysteries in the faith that cannot be explained entirely rationally, that you can kind of approach. But they don't get it. They can't understand what a rational faith would be. And so one of the first things, I think, that a Christian intellectual has to understand about the world that you move in is that lots of people are confused about faith and reason, and that you need to be clear yourself. You need to dig into that yourself and understand as much as your God-given capabilities allow you to know how those two things function, because that is a central question in the world. Lots of young people leave the churches over sexual matters, of course. A lot of them say, and in surveys actually more than those who disagree about sexual ethics, that they leave because they think science has disproved religion. Now, I tend to think, since I have great skepticism about all polls, political and non-political, I tend to think that maybe they're trying not to talk about sex when they talk about science. I've been in Washington too long. I've grown cynical. But look, we've got to engage that question. We've got to engage that question of how do we reconcile the tremendous, not only truth developments in science, but the technological developments. You know, everyone talks about how your smartphone is the closest thing to one of Tolkien's palantirs, you know, where you can see everywhere with it, and it's true. You know, my wife gets crazy because we'll be at dinner and she'll raise a question, and I'll say, "Well, let me look that up." "Oh no, no, we don't look that up during dinner. That's you know, that's not allowed." It used to be, I think, that the science questions were easier. You know, it used to be mostly Darwin. There are some people that still worry about Darwin, but and some who think that Darwin disproves science, and some who think that it religion, and some who think that it's a threat. But I think once you start to think through the implications of simply blind evolution, those things kind of explode. There's a famous saying by Vladimir Soloviev, was his name. He was a Russian Orthodox thinker who became Catholic and therefore kind of united both the Eastern and Western streams of thought and of spirituality. And he said once that the whole problem in the world, the post-Darwinian world, is that we have to say we are all descended from apes and therefore let us love one another. It's a serious question. You know, if we're all just descended from apes, how is it that the charity and truth and whatnot enter into our lives? The situation has gotten much, much worse since then. I'm quite prepared to believe that neuroscience is going to give us all kinds of benefits going down the line. Some of you may even be studying neurosciences. But I notice in some of the debates I get involved with that we're getting very close to the point of denying free will. That actually some neuroscientists talk about free will as a folk belief. Just no kidding. It's a folk belief. I always wonder why then they even care, because if everything is determined, you know, we can all just kind of kick back and have a beer. And it's going to be what it is anyway, so we don't have to bother about it. It's an incoherent position. It even goes to the point that it seems to deny the mind, that we can know the truth. And it's kind of a bad philosophical move to make an argument to express an idea that ideas don't exist or that truth doesn't exist. It doesn't work all that well. There's a book that came out a few years ago by a rather prominent American philosopher, Thomas Nagel. It's called Mind and Cosmos: Why the Materialist Neo-Darwinian View of the World is Almost Surely False. Here's a man who was a very famous kind of materialist philosopher, and he knows now that it's not working. But you can tell from that title, he's making a bold statement, but he's kind of also timid about making it because he knows he's gonna get a reaction. I myself here I'm going to kind of stray over into some more political considerations. I myself here a few years ago at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars was involved in a debate with E.O. Wilson, who's a biologist. He's an entomologist. I think he studies insects. He'd written a book called Consilience, in which he tries to draw together all the different sciences, all the different modes of knowledge, into a harmonious expression of you know, human understanding. And he was going on, and we were in the Jefferson Room at the Woodrow Wilson Center for Scholars. And I said to him, "Professor Wilson, I don't hear liberty, I don't hear freedom in anything that you're saying." And he said, no, wait, he said, "Don't get me wrong. All I'm saying is that 40% of our behavior is determined by our genes. The other 60% is a complex algorithm between our genes and the environment." I said to him, "Complex algorithm? I don't think Thomas Jefferson would have thought that was a good guarantee of our liberties." But, you know, we left it there. These are the impasses that we're coming to, and that even if they are philosophically kind of absurd, the manifest success of science and of technology make it appear that that form of reason alone represents the truth. And Catholic intellectuals, Christian intellectuals need to not only be aware of that, but be thinking about ways to respond to it. I often like to quote from the American founding when this particular question comes up, because I've mentioned how difficult in a way it is to justify belief in human dignity and respect toward others if you don't have that older natural law metaphysical view. And the American founders knew this. When the Declaration of Independence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men have been created equal, that they've been endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Very famous phrase. We all know that phrase. They're making affirmations. They're making very serious affirmations about where they thought the foundations of liberty and human dignity come out of the Creator. make a religious affirmation. Have any of you ever read John Courtney Murray's We Hold These Truths? It's a fabulous book. It came out, in the mid-60s. And Murray was a Jesuit. He was trying at the time, he knew that it was that even back then, natural law arguments are kind of weak. In fact, one of the chapters in the book, if I remember right, is it basket weaving? You know, do people still do basket weaving at universities? It used to be a joke back in the 60s and 70s that the football players would take a course in basket weaving so they'd have enough credits to continue on the field. You know. So he was making the joke about natural law that is it basket weaving? Is it just kind of make work study that's never going to do anything? But what he said about that famous phrase from the Declaration of Independence is that it says at least three or four different things. I'm going to talk only about three of them. The first is that there are truths, right? That the American idea of freedom is not based on the idea that there aren't truths, there's nothing above us, we make whatever truths we want. There are truths, he says. And second, he says, we can know them. You know, it's not like an agnostic may be able to say, yeah, there may be truth out there, but we can't know it. John Courtney Murray is saying definitely, they're not only truths, but we can know those truths. And the Declaration specifies a couple of them, right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And then finally, he says, so our intellects are engaged in knowing the truth. Finally, he says, and we, meaning we Americans, hold these truths. We they aren't just out there, we don't just know them. We actually think that we hold on to these truths because they're important to the type of society that we want to found. Now, it's a much reduced view of natural law than if you're studying Aquinas or other great Christian thinkers, but it's there. And I think it gives us at least a thread that we can begin to hold on to perhaps go somewhere. Now, all this is just the merest portal to a bunch of debates that we may want to have in our question and answer period. But let me just mention one other feature of what I think Christian intellectuals have to be aware of right now. When I've taught philosophy in the past, what I usually tell the students at the beginning, because they're very nervous, they all think that reason is going to explode their faith. But what I tell them is this: look, I'm going to explain to you things about the philosophical tradition. We're going to see how those interact with our 2,000-year history of Christian thought, not just Christian practice, but Christian thought. And that when we're done, you will pass the exam, I hope, and maybe you won't remember any of this once you are no longer in this class. But you will remember, I hope, that there are answers, and there are people who are credible and trustworthy who have those answers, and that you can be confident. Remember I talked about the metaphysical dream of the world and how you have a backdrop of that metaphysics. This is quite important because, as we know, Aquinas talks about this at the beginning of Contri Gentiles, if I'm not mistaken. We know most people can't do philosophy. They can't do philosophy, they can't do theology. Either their intellectual gifts are insufficient, or they don't have the time, or their lives are chaotic, or whatever it may be. So that it's at the beginning of the Contri Gentiles where he says, did God reveal truths that we could have arrived at by natural reason? And he says, of course he did, because there are very few people who can get to these questions. Many of them are complicated. And therefore, it was a great mercy that he revealed some of these things. But we, those of us who are going to be thinkers, have to recognize that we have to build up in people, whether it's your students or other people that you interact with, a certain confidence about this very rich Christian tradition, that we can't always be proving everything, right? I mean, first of all, first principles can't be proven. They can only be they can only be perceived as you work your way to them, and then recognizing that those are a kind of a foundation. And as we do that, we also have to convey the sense that, as John Paul II put it in Felix et Ratio, we need a reason of true metaphysical reach. That people can be confident that there are ways that we can reach out in reason that enable us to be reasonably confident about what our faith teaches. Now, this used to be, I think this used to be conveyed in Catholic institutions, maybe in Protestant institutions too. I don't know if it is any longer. My next-door neighbor, we recently moved, but my next-door neighbor at my old house was a military veteran, retired, and he went to a small Midwestern Catholic liberal arts college. And a lot of guys his age, they maybe had to study economics, or they, you know, get a job in business, or they studied math, and they went into the military, and they did sort of technical jobs. But he always used to tell me how much philosophy and theology was kind of where he thought the action was at the university. He wasn't able to study it himself. His parents didn't want him to do it. But they knew that that was really the higher end of thought, the higher end of study at the university level. And then there was the one great day that he was out cutting his lawn and I was cutting mine. And he said to me, he turned his lawnmower off and he said, "Hey, Bob, have you ever heard of Jacques Maritain?" I said, "Yeah, I've kind of written a lot of stuff about it." And he said, "Oh, really?" He used to read my books. But really, there was this way that institutions conveyed a certain confidence and also conveyed that there was a certain importance in philosophical and theological reasoning. I hear complaints from all my academic friends that nobody cares about this anymore. All people want are jobs. And I say, well, it's your job to make sure that they understand that that's not the case, that no matter what you're going to do, it's going to be important to understand who God is, what the nature of the world is, what human beings are, the Christian anthropology, and how a life needs to be lived. Now, let me conclude with this rather sober thought. Much depends for all of us on the church being allowed to be the church. And right now we're seeing religious speech and even practice being limited in North America and in Europe in the name of tolerance. This is that bizarre kind of double standard that I talked about earlier, when radical autonomy is making claims that everybody has a right to define their meaning of the universe, and then at the same time, when you define your meaning in, say, Christian or natural law terms, it's horrible and you should be shunned. The church has got to push back and recognize that it needs to push back at all levels, and that means all of us, all the time, in whatever circumstances we're in, because the space of religious freedom is shrinking. There's a very distinguished Polish intellectual journalist, I think he's a professor at the Jagiellonian University now. His name is Ryszard Legutko. He wrote a book called The Demon in Democracy, and like Rod Dreher and Patrick Deneen and some others, he's noticed certain problems with the way that Western traditions of liberty have kind of morphed into their opposite and are actually threatening the ancient and Christian views of human persons and human societies. And he wrote an essay recently in First Things, last couple of months, in which he made what I thought was an amazing observation. He talks about how the Poles, after the Berlin Wall fell, how they thought that the West, because they didn't know a lot about the West, was still the sort of classical West of Christianity and the Enlightenment and philosophy, and there was still this continuity. So let me just read you this passage. It's a little long, but I think it's worth reading as we're coming to our conclusion. "The pictures the Poles had of this civilization," meaning us, "was from before all these changes, all the things that I've been talking about, when Christianity was relatively strong and classical, metaphysics and epistemology were still very much not only in the air, but in the educational curricula." Imagine that. "This picture presupposed a continuity, not easy to describe, but taken for granted, between antiquity and Christianity on the one hand, and modern times on the other. Nobility of soul, moral virtue, sainthood, and salvation were seen as continuous with ideas of mobility, liberty, and democratic republicanism. Even the Enlightenment and Romanticism were included as dissenting voices within a civilization that remained classical and Christian. For Eastern Europeans, it was unimaginable that Western civilization could dissociate from all this, as if from some burdensome impedimenta, just like communism did, to the despair of those who lived under its rule. Now, this is the man who is the editor-in-chief of the Solidarity newspaper in the heyday of Solidarity when they revolted against the communist regime in Poland, and that led to the downfall of the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact. So, by way of conclusion, this may be an odd reflection, and it's certainly not something to be proud of for any of us, of course, but God himself has chosen each one of us to be in this place at this time. It's a time of profound division in society, post-truth, as I've been calling it, profound division in the church when our efforts to accompany people and to be merciful toward them are putting somewhat at risk, as I tried to explain, the truth claims that Christianity makes, those important truth claims that undergird everything else in our societies. And yet, I think we can say that it's a great calling, a great vocation to be asked by God to be in the world at this moment. It reminded me of this World War I poem by Rupert Brooke, probably the greatest British poet of World War I. It's called Peace, and the first three lines go like this. Now God be thanked who has matched us with this his hour and caught our youth and wakened us from sleeping with hand made sure, clear eye, and sharpened power. That describes all of you. I mean, unless you think that God was trying to get you by putting you in a rough time like this, this is a great responsibility, but an inspiring challenge too. And it's an inspiring challenge for every one of us at this time. That is finally what I would say is the vocation of the Christian intellectual. I pray that we are all worthy of this calling, and I hope that this week and this talk gave you some inspiration toward continuing on that path. Thank you.
So Dr. Royal is willing to entertain some questions.
Do you think, given this situation of post-truth in the world and the church's call to respond to this and some of the weaknesses you see in some of the leadership in the situation, what do you think the role of the Catholic University is? Just in general, not this one, or though including this one, the Catholic University is in contributing to this this revival of truth.
It would be good if it did that. Yeah, because one of the problems, of course, is that it's difficult to point to Catholic universities as any different than any other universities right now. And the universities are the places where I don't think it's unfair to say where the dominance of that non-metaphysical view, that view of autonomous will, is most institutionalized right now. I mean, maybe somebody wants to dispute this, but I can name specific institutions, and this one and the one across the street are, I think, honorable exceptions to that. But it seems to me that there's a whole literature about this. It seems to me that for the last 50 years or so, the Catholic universities put so much emphasis on being competitive with secular universities and on the same terms as the secular universities thought about the intellectual life that they lost touch with a lot of what was important in the tradition. When my brother went to Providence College, my brother's a priest now, but when my brother went to Providence College, And by the way, I was in Providence too. I was at Brown University during the Vietnam War. You don't want to know about this. He took 8 philosophy courses. So in other words, in over 4 years, he took 2 philosophy courses every year, meaning basically every semester. Now, these were probably fairly watered down history of philosophy, but not all that serious. But when you spend every semester, in every semester you have one class in philosophy, you're in touch with some real thinking, you know, a different way of thinking than the world thinks about things. That doesn't exist at Providence College anymore, and I wonder where, other than maybe the Dominican House, such a thing could be found. Maybe COA's beefed this up. But we have to start from where we are. We have to recognize that we have a very rich tradition that was kind of mislaid for a while, and it's not going to be fixed in any kind of hurry, but I think everywhere we can, we need to try to make some inroads. One of the things that Faith and Reason Institute does, by the way, every summer we run about between 4 and 6 Fides et Ratio seminars in which we bring together faculty from Catholic institutions, and we just read books together. We have a few lectures, but we mostly just read books together, and there are scientists, and there are theologians, and there are people in literature from all different disciplines, and we just try to reconnect with the Catholic tradition, talk among ourselves about, you know, what do these books say, what experience did I have with my students when I taught this, what kind of pushback is there, where can some progress be made? We now probably have 700 alumni of that program at 75 or 80 universities and colleges. It hasn't noticeably changed, you know, Catholic higher education, but it does something. And I think every step that we can take, however modest, we need to take. But beginning with the idea that, you know, we've got something quite important that we need to focus on, and that ultimately all the studies that we undertake are for a certain purpose. Was somebody, did you want to? I'm right behind you first, and then, yeah.
I wanted to ask you a question. Thank you for the talk about the Bible. I wanted to ask a question around political strategy. And so following John Courtney Murray and that book, it seemed like the sort of strategy that Catholics, particularly in America, but across the Western world, have taken has been to engage with the culture war on the sort of secular world's terms. So they've done things like try to sort of build a new natural law and sort of kept God out of it. And as we've been learning this week, that narrow picture really does sort of reduce the natural law to kind of a set of rules or obligations without necessarily presenting the goods of the faith and God as kind of ultimate end. It seems like what you're doing and different strategies that you're trying are sort of a pushback on that accommodation and are trying to engage explicitly with the and not concede the ground that God is dead or that the secular world sort of wins the battle that God can stand in the public square. I'm wondering if how that's been received or if that's been a conscious decision and whether you think that strategy or trying that as a new strategy given the more success rate that the other strategies have had in the last few years, whether that's a conscious strategy and whether you would encourage us to sort of pursue that as a political strategy.
I'm going to give you a very unenlightening answer. I don't know anymore. In the 1980s when I came to Washington, Pope John Paul II was the Pope. Ronald Reagan was the president, Margaret Thatcher was the prime minister of England, and you'd come in every day and you would say, we can make some progress on these issues. So there's a lot of respectful talk about religion in the public square. I'm sorry, my voice is getting weak from allergies. I'll try to speak up pretty badly. Things have changed a lot since. Just to talk about the politics, clearly Bill Clinton bounced off certain religious ideas for political gain. I think George W. Bush was a sincere believer, but I think didn't have a clue about how to talk about religion in the public square. Things are much more difficult. because it isn't just a matter of religion, because there's division within churches, within Judaism, and that allows people who want to keep religion out of the public square to say, you know, we don't want that debate in the public square, we don't want any further division. So it's hard to know at this point, it's hard to know in terms of economics, in terms of not only electoral politics, but sort of political theory. I've had some pages about Patrick Deneen's book that I was filming a little bit too long ago. Have you talked about that book at all this week? Deneen has a book out called Why Liberalism Failed. And he says it failed because it succeeded. It was so successful in promoting a radical liberty that it destroyed itself. I think that he overstates a little bit sort of the logic and obviously way of understanding the founder. I think there's enough natural law in the founder to at least build out. But I don't know anymore. I really think that the situation is very, very fluid. It could go very, very bad. We could see a return. Religion was sort of out of favor, I would say, in the 70s. It became a little bit stronger for with Jim Carter and his Reagan. There were these ups and downs in the political journey. So nothing seems to be an ideal solution in any economics, politics, moral culture. I'm sorry, that's not a great answer.
So thank you so much, Monsieur Aubert Royal. You know, my question, by your testimony in the COVID sphere in terms of mission evangelization, it's really touching to a person like me, a religious person. In touch with what you say, you know, Paul Ricoeur, I am sure that you know about him, Paul Ricoeur spoke of post-Christian age of faith. And for him, the age of faith or the age of Christianity is over because Christians are disappearing species. So my question is, how to preach not only as a leader, but also as a lay person like you, in this post-Christian age of faith. I'm saying this because you did mention Catholic school. In Africa, where I came from, Catholic school are very expensive in terms of, you know, performing. I am now schooling in Canada, in the same thing. So my hope, I can hope if public schools, or if Catholic school were like public school with too many people, so you can at least try to face these challenges. So given the nature of our school, very expensive, we don't even have people, we are closing our faculty almost everywhere, even in Africa. So I don't know what is your stand on this. So how to preach with all of this? You know, people are going more and more towards New Age religion. You know, they are refusing Christianity. They prefer transcendental spirituality. So this is also my challenge here. So don't say I'm monopolizing the world, you know. In Africa, we, as black priests, or priests to be, some people are calling us traitors. For them, we are serving those who came to invade them in terms of oppression, colonial and post-colonial oppression. I went to Canada, a Canadian brother or some Canadian priest told me, well, you are coming also here to invade. Don't think that we are going to go and bring priests from Africa to help for mission here. We prefer to ordain married men. So that is for me a challenge. I'm like at the crossroads on this. But my question is, how to preach in this type of
thank you. Any other questions? Preach. I mentioned earlier, Aquinas says one of the biggest miracles was poor fishermen and tax collectors produced this church that exists all over the world. I mean, the difference, of course, now is people already know about Christianity. It's not something that's absolutely musical, it's spread out mission. But there's still power in gospel. I think we have to have confidence in truth.
kind of made a deal with God. I'm not supposed to make a deal with God, but I made a deal with God when I started doing think tank work, that the day that I didn't tell the truth any longer in public, I would know what it's done. That or the money that I But all these problems have multiple dimensions. You have practical dimensions. If we didn't have the system that we have here in the United States of philanthropy, we wouldn't be able to have independent think tanks to push back a little bit at the universe of the culture. As I always tell people who want to come to work for me, there are 1,000 people for every one that we have. There's $1,000, maybe $1 million for every $1 that we have. And if you can work under those circumstances, then fine. Right? We just have to work it. There's no magic solution. I don't know how to solve that financial problem in the country. When I was growing up in the United States, our Catholic school system was vast, and I think it was educating 6 million students a year. It's now down to about 2 million. It's not because people don't want to go to it, but it's because they're not as educated. There's been a demographic collapse in Catholics. It would be visible here in the United States if it wasn't for Hispanic immigration. But we're going to probably be in for a period of some reduction. Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict, used to talk about how there's going to be a period when the church is much smaller than it was in the past. Certainly in Germany, where he's from, that's the case. But it's always creative minorities that make a difference. So I don't have a specific answer. I wish I did for these sorts of things. But you know, we do what we can do, and we assume that God's going to be the one who makes it happen anyway. I'm sorry, I totally agree with the fact that I have a connection for this. Go ahead, Pat.
Yeah, thank you. I totally agree that our work today is supposed to fill the world, and I totally agree with you that there is a need for Catholic intellectuals to search for that. However, my question will be, as my sister here said, the origin, the people who are our audience, are no longer like in the Middle Ages, where the church had the primacy, and where the church would speak, everyone listen. Today, our audience is reducing, and I don't see it changing any soon. Eventually, it will change, but it's reducing. How then will we transmit that truth? And after transmission, if we can transmit it, eventually by preaching or other means, what are the strategies for that, so that people can listen to the truth they are transmitting and eventually follow that truth?
Well, I think that the truth is going to be under a lot of pressure in the short run. We were talking about this before we came in. I know you would see Justice Alito today. And there is some good news in the fact that the Supreme Court, even in the past, has been defended religiously. But I think there's going to be much more pressure to squeeze out not religion per se, but religious truth. We can kind of worship the church, even the Soviet Union said to do that. But there's going to be pressure, I think. We see this already in more prestigious Catholic universities, Georgetown, Notre Dame. There's pressure to kind of back off from some of the harder truths of faith. Now that said, what can we do? We can be faithful. That's all we can do. I don't know that the universities can continue much longer the way they are. I think that they're destroying themselves. Maybe the Catholic institutions a little less than the others. But if you see articles here in the United States, where are you from?
I'm from Guana.
You see articles here in the United States by liberal professors saying, I'm a liberal and I'm terrified of my students. Because I use the wrong pronoun towards somebody, or you know, I just make a bad joke, some people are fired all the time. I don't think that people are going to stand for this. I think it's getting worse and worse, and it's just human sanity that's certainly going to respond.
but it's not going to be easy. I think we're going to, we have to prepare ourselves. This is where I think Ron Dreher, because all of you know this book by Ron Dreher, The Bad Reconstruction. He isn't exactly calling for, he keeps saying this to people all the week, he isn't calling for a withdrawal from society. But I think the useful thing that he's saying, he doesn't have much in the restrictions either, so I'm not alone. The useful thing that he's saying is prepare because the threat is getting overwhelmed. And we can try to have a little enclave to preserve some path of truth, some teaching, community, charity toward one another. I don't know how much of that can survive if the political pressures really get bad. And they could. I don't think they will as much in Trump for all his inconsistencies. I think between that and the Supreme Court, there's at least some protections for the next few years. But we really need to take seriously that we're in an odd period. And we're in a period that's post-truth, and we're in a period when the church doesn't know very much how to respond to the situation. So it isn't even as if it's a fortress or it's a field hospital. It's confused. And yet we, people who think about this, have to be able to engage both the world and to help the churches in thinking through what we're supposed to do.